Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, you can learn interesting things about what is happening in our world. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Today, we will talk about the Internet and your right to privacy. Is there something about you out there that you would like to keep secret? What can you do about it? We will give you some thoughts from the experts. Then, we will talk about American politics. A leading Republican Party advisor says that Hillary Clinton's health could be an issue if she decides to try to become this country's first woman president. Those are two items that will get you thinking. This is As It Is from VOA. The European Court of Justice recently ruled in a case involving the internet search engine Google. The court said that Google must sometimes, on request, remove links to reports containing personal information. The case has led to a public debate about this right to be forgotten. Many people are now asking which is more important, the right to privacy or the freedom of information. Glenn Gabe is president of G Squared Interactive. The company has provided digital marketing services to businesses, business leaders, and movie stars. He says many people have something in their past that they would like to remove from the internet.
They went to prison, right? And maybe 10 years ago everything happened, and everything's still showing up in Google on page one, even though that they paid their dues.
Mark Rottenberg is head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He agrees with the European Court of Justice that privacy is a basic right.
You have to consider the ability of individuals to control the dissemination of information about themselves. That is, in many respects, the core of free expression, how we choose to express ourselves or not to say things or do things. That's, you know, what makes us human.
In the United States, a number of privacy activists disagree with the European Court's Google ruling. Jules Polonetsky is head of a group called the Future of Privacy Forum. He says the ruling is likely to limit the freedom of information.
So if someone can tell search engines or news aggregators or maybe bloggers, sorry, that information tells us about some individual, that individual doesn't want to be found, you need to take it down, the effects really could be dramatic. It breaks the internet.
The European Court ordered Google to remove links containing personal information about a Spanish lawyer. He asked the company to take down links to his 1998 tax problems because the information was old and no longer important. The right to a free press is noted in the United States Constitution. But the right to privacy is suggested only indirectly. Jules Polonetsky says the right to public information must be protected.
So it's a real blow to transparency if legal public information can be obscured simply because somebody decides that it's information they'd rather not be available.
Mark Rottenberg disagrees. He says the European judges did a good job of balancing privacy with press freedom.
And what the European Court of Justice has done with this decision is to say, in effect, you know, search is an important service, but it has to be done in a way that protects privacy.
The court ruling will be costly for Google and other search engines in Europe, but it is not expected to affect their U.S. operations anytime soon. Americans will be electing a new president in 2 years. Many people expect former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to seek the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. Last week, a leading advisor to the Republican Party angered her supporters when he raised questions about her health. Katie Weaver has more on what some observers say could be an early look at the 2016 presidential campaign.
Last week, the New York Post published a story based on the comments of Republican Party advisor Karl Rove. He formerly served as a political advisor to George W. Bush during his presidency. During a recent speech, Mr. Rove raised questions about the health of Hillary Clinton. The newspaper used the words brain damage at the top of its report. Ms. Clinton was treated for a blood clot in 2012 after suffering a concussion, a minor brain injury, in a fall at her home. Hillary Clinton has not publicly commented about what Mr. Rove said in the speech last Friday. Former President Bill Clinton laughingly dismissed Karl Rove's comments. He said his wife is in good health.
Now they say she's really got brain damage.
You think they're just
trying
to?
If she does, then I must be in really tough shape because she's still quicker than I am.
Karl Rove sought to clarify his comments in an appearance on Fox News television.
She had a serious health episode. This will be an issue in the 2016 race, whether she likes it or not.
Ms. Clinton says she will decide on the possibility of a presidential election campaign by the end of this year. Celinda Lake works for the Democratic Party. She studies the likes and dislikes of voters. She says Ms. Clinton can expect more political attacks if she decides to seek the nomination.
Just as people were unbounded in their commentary about Obama, they will be unbounded in their commentary on her. And that is, she's tough enough, she can take it, she's taken it for years.
A special congressional committee is expected to raise questions about Hillary Clinton's record as Secretary of State. Republican members set up the committee to investigate the attack 2 years ago on the American diplomatic offices in Benghazi, Libya. The attack resulted in the deaths of 4 Americans. The former Secretary of State defended her actions and decisions during a Senate hearing in 2013.
Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
Carlin Bowman is an expert on public opinion. She says Republicans often attacked Hillary Clinton during the 8 years her husband served as president.
There's a base of opposition to Hillary Clinton. It's part of the Republican conservative base, and that's not inconsequential, but I think she looks like a pretty strong candidate at this point.
Ms. Clinton has written a book about her years as Secretary of State. That book, called Hard Choices, will be released next month. I'm Katie Weaver.
Thanks, Katie. We know that many of you around the world listen to the program on shortwave, medium wave, and FM radio. But if you have access to the internet, you can learn and improve your American English much quicker. Go to learningenglish.voanews.com and check out our website. First, click on the link that says audio in the blue bar at the top. Then click on As It Is. Finally, click the audio link under As It Is, and you'll find podcasts of all our programs. You can listen to them anytime you want, or even download them and save them on your computer. You will also find all of the words for any program written out for you. You may read them off your computer screen, or print them out and save them for later. We suggest you practice reading the words we say while listening to us say them. You may want to try imitating your favorite VOA announcer and talking like he or she does. We think it is an easy and convenient way to learn English. And best of all, it's free. That's all for this time, but stay tuned if you are listening on the radio for more Learning English programs up next. Then, at the beginning of the hour, you can hear all the latest news from around the world. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We hope you will come back tomorrow. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Health Report. Cigarette smoking kills. That we know. So manufacturers made electronic cigarettes as a safer smoking choice, safer than tobacco. E-cigarettes contain the drug nicotine, like cigarettes. But they do not use tobacco. And you do not light them. They are powered by battery. So if e-cigarettes are so safe, why have poison control centers around the United States seen an increase in telephone calls about e-cigarette poisonings? The answer is children. Most of the calls are from people worried about children who have played with the devices. In the period of 1 month this year, the United States Centers for Disease Control say 215 people called the center with e-cigarette concerns. More than half of these calls were for children, ages 5 and younger. The devices apparently had made them sick. Tim McAfee is director of the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health. He says the problem is regulation, meaning the U.S. federal government does not control e-cigarettes, even though they contain liquid nicotine. Mr. McAfee adds that liquid nicotine is a well-known danger.
Nicotine historically has been used as a pesticide in the United States, and that's where we have really for many decades had significant poisonings when people got exposed to nicotine that was in liquid solutions.
Mr. McAfee explains that nicotine poisoning happens when the substance gets into the skin, gets into the eyes, or is swallowed. Even a small amount, he says, can make a person sick. Nicotine poisoning can cause stomach pain. Headaches and seizures are also common signs of nicotine poisoning, and too much nicotine can kill. Tim McAfee says e-cigarettes do not create the level of risk to people that tobacco products do. He notes that almost 500,000 Americans die each year from cigarettes.
So cigarettes are the winner, you know, in that contest, and we don't really know what's going to happen with e-cigarettes.
E-cigarettes do not contain hundreds of harmful chemicals that are found in real cigarettes. So the U.S. Surgeon General has suggested that e-cigarettes may be a useful tool for adults trying to end their tobacco use. But Mr. McAfee worries that teenagers may think electronic cigarettes are harmless. They could become addicted or hooked on the nicotine and then start smoking real cigarettes. And that's the Health Report. I'm Anna Mateo. But don't go anywhere. There's more VOA Learning English coming right up.
This is Steve Ember.
And this is Bob Doty with the VOA Special English Program, Explorations. Today, we tell about how people learned an important piece of information necessary for safely sailing on the oceans. It is called longitude.
On a foggy October night in 1707, four English Navy ships hit rocks in the Atlantic Ocean and sank. 2,000 men drowned. The ships had been sailing in the thick fog for 12 days. There was no sure way to know where they were. The commander of the ships had been worried that they could hit rocks if they were not careful. He asked his navigators for their opinion on their location in the ocean. The navigators did not really know. They told the commander they thought they were west of a small island near the coast of northwestern France. They were wrong. Instead, they sailed on to rocks near a small group of islands southwest of England's Atlantic coast. The navigators' lack of knowledge led to the loss of four ships and 2,000 lives.
When people began sailing out of sight of land, sailors did not know how to tell where they were on the open sea. Land travelers can look at a mountain or a river or an object that shows them where they are in relation to where they came from. On the ocean, however, there is no sign to tell a sailor where he is. The most important device for knowing directions on the ocean is a compass. A compass is a device containing a metal object that points toward the magnetic North Pole. This shows navigators the direction of north, and therefore also south, east, and west. But sailors need more information to sail safely on the open sea.
Most maps of the world show lines that are not on the Earth's surface. One line is the equator. It is an imaginary line around the widest part of the Earth. There are similar lines both north and south of the equator. These circles become smaller and smaller toward the North Pole and the South Pole. These lines, or circles, are parallel, meaning that they are equally distant from each other at any point around the world. These lines show what is called latitude. A navigator can know the latitude of his ship by observing the location of stars, where the sun rises in the morning and sets in the evening, and what time of year it is. With this information, he knows where his ship is in relation to the North or South Pole and the equator.
Still, there is one more important piece of information necessary for safely sailing the oceans. For many centuries, scientists, astronomers, and inventors searched for a way to tell longitude. The lines of longitude go the other way from latitude lines. They stretch from the North Pole to the South Pole and back again in great circles of the same size. All of the lines of longitude meet at the top and bottom of the world. In her book, Longitude, writer Deva Sobel tells the story about longitude and how the problem of knowing it was solved.
For centuries, the great scientists of the world struggled to develop a way to learn longitude. To learn longitude at any place requires knowledge about time. A navigator needs to know what time it is on his ship, and also the time at another place of known longitude at the very same moment. The Earth takes 24 hours to complete one full turn or revolution of 360 degrees. 1 hour marks 1/24th of a turn or 15 degrees. So each hour's time difference between the ship and the starting point marks a ship's progress of 15 degrees of longitude to the east or west. Those 15 degrees of longitude mark a distance traveled. At the equator, where the Earth is widest, 15 degrees stretches about 1,600 kilometers. North or south of that line, however, the distance value of each degree decreases. 1 degree of longitude equals 4 minutes of time all around the world. But in measuring distance, 1 degree shrinks from about 109 kilometers at the equator to nothing at the North and South Poles.
For many centuries, navigators hoped they could find longitude by observing the movement of stars at night. During the day, the sun provided information about the time on a ship and its direction. However, it did not provide necessary information about the time somewhere else. In the 16th century, one astronomer suggested that navigators could observe the moon as it passed in front of different known stars to tell longitude. But there was not enough information about the stars to use this method effectively. Astronomers could not tell exactly where the moon would be from one night or day to the next. Yet, it seemed to those seeking to solve the longitude problem that the only solution was in the moon and stars.
During the 17th century, English astronomers began a major effort to map the stars and their relationship to the moon as it passed across the sky. Royal astronomer John Flamsteed worked at this task for 40 years. The next royal astronomer, Edmund Halley, spent another 40 years gathering information about the moon's orbit. After many years of gathering the necessary information, it became possible to learn longitude by observing the stars and the moon. In 1766, Royal astronomer Neville Maskelyne published the Nautical Almanac and Astronomical Ephemeris. It contained all the necessary information about the moon and stars that sailors would need to help them learn their longitude. This new method was not simple. A navigator had to use complex observing instruments to note the position of the moon and stars. Then he had to seek the correct information in the nautical almanac about the moon and stars at that time of night or day. The final step in the process was to take the mathematical information from the book, link it to the current information, and solve the resulting problem. This took an average of 4 hours to do.
While scientists were studying the stars and moon to solve the longitude problem, a man named John Harrison was working on another project. He was trying to build a clock that would help sailors learn longitude. His task also was difficult and complex. Mr. Harrison had to develop a clock that was not affected by the movement of a ship on the ocean, or changes in temperature or atmospheric pressure. He began developing his clock in 1730. It took 5 years to complete. The complex device weighed 34 kilograms. Several years later, Mr. Harrison built a second clock. It was smaller, but weighed more than the first. Mr. Harrison was not satisfied and began working on yet another device. 20 years later, he completed a device that was smaller than the first two and weighed less. But still, Mr. Harrison was not satisfied. 2 years later, in 1757, he produced a small clock that he could hold in his hand. The clock could tell the correct time in two places, meeting the requirements for learning longitude on the sea.
For many years after Mr. Harrison's work was completed, the idea of using a clock to learn longitude was rejected. However, that opinion changed when manufacturers learned how to make better and less costly versions of Mr. Harrison's clocks. The clocks became known as chronometers. By 1815, 5,000 chronometers were in use on ships sailing the world's oceans. The complex documents and mathematical work were no longer necessary. Almost any sailor could tell what his longitude was by simply looking at a clock. The world had changed.
John Harrison's clocks can be seen today at the Old Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England. The first three are still operating, showing the correct time. To look at them is to see the simple solution to a problem that worried people for many centuries. Today, the solution to the problem is so common that it is difficult to understand that there was a problem at all.
This program was written by Oliver Chandler and produced by Paul Thompson. Our audio engineer was Al Alavi. This is Steve Ember.
And this is Bob Doty. Join us again next week for Explorations, a program in special English on the Voice of America.